When you're designing and building pages covering architecture, deciding on your materials can be a tricky challenge, and the solutions are diverse, whether it's the abundance of design prowess inside the pages of Lobby magazine or the expertly crafted minimalism of Disegno. We're dusting off our drafting pads today on The Stack. Coming up today, from mid-century marvels to modern brutalism, we're digging deep into the pages of some of today's most influential architectural magazines.
It's a pleasure to read, and the way that I describe it is like architectural hors d'oeuvres. So we have this platter in front of you and we give you a small selection, and they're very, very short pieces unless it's an interview.
And in a week that saw the first posthumous unveiling of a Zaha Hadid design in the Italian city of Salerno, we'll ponder the relationship between standing out and fitting in. All that ahead here on The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis programme. Hello and welcome to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Studio One is particularly cosy today. I'm here with three guests, count them. James Taylor Foster, the European Editor-at-Large for ArchDaily.com and co-curator of the Nordic Pavilion at the upcoming Venice Biennale. He's also an editor of Lobby magazine. Alongside him, we have Regna Ramos, editor-in-chief of the aforementioned Lobby magazine, and we have a few of those here with us in studio. We're also lucky to welcome Johanna Agerman-Ross, editor-in-chief of Designer magazine, who's also here. Welcome, one and all.
Thank you.
Hello.
What a pleasing vista it is here in Studio One. Let's catch up with what you've all been up to since last we spoke, or in some cases, the first time we've spoken. James, a good friend of ours, of course, here at Midori House. How's things? How excited are you about the fresh issue of Lobby magazine?
Incredibly excited. And you know, we have our launch party tonight as well at the Bartlett School of Architecture in London. So there's been a lot of preparations going on. Regna has been more involved in the preparations than I have, but they're always extremely fun.
Now, Regna, you look pretty bright-eyed. Normally getting a magazine ready, all of the various stresses and strains, they can take their toll on editors, but you seem pretty chipper.
Well, we finished production of the magazine a few weeks ago, so I've just been enjoying seeing it for the first time, which is always super exciting when you see what it looks like. And I'm excited about tonight as well. So it's a good week.
It's a good place to be. And just tell us a little bit about, for those not familiar, obviously we've seen a few iterations now of Lobby magazine, and they have these sort of thematics. We're talking about abundance, of course, in the spring summer edition. Maybe just remind us, you know, why do you like to kind of deal with a theme in this way? What is it about that helps the kind of editorial structure?
I think it helps to give it exactly that, a bit of structure, a bit of coherence. I think people also have, because we accept collaborations with people who are from outside the school or from outside the team, I think it helps them be able to pitch ideas that work alongside that parameter that we've set. So I also think it gives you a great degree of flexibility to be creative with something that, like abundance or defiance or clairvoyance, which aren't themes that are so predominant in architecture. So we like to pick a word, play with it, and see them from different perspectives, whether it's in photographs or illustrations or articles or roundtables or interviews.
I think it's interesting, that playful approach. I mean, we'll come back to that when we talk a bit about, you know, covering architecture well. But Johanna, I'd like to bring you in here, because talking about, you know, the evolution of magazines, which is always an interesting sort of journey, and it's exciting times indeed for designer. Tell us, well, it's interesting because there's a reference to our own editor-in-chief, Tyler Brûlé, at the start of your letter, where you make the announcement. Tell us exactly what's happening.
Disegno is now celebrating 5 years and our 10th issue, which we launched in Milan a couple of weeks ago. And with this issue, we're going quarterly. Before that, we were actually biannual, so we came out twice a year, autumn, winter. And now we're adding twice as many issues every year, which obviously is a big commitment on our side, but also a very, as you say, interesting evolution, and something that I hope will show our intention towards what we want to write about design and architecture, but also how we want to approach that in being more frequent.
I mean, I guess we're going to be talking a bit on the programme today about, you know, how you write well, how you document architecture well. How do you suspect, I guess, is the question at this stage, that changing metabolism will reflect on that? Do you think that will, in a way, change the stories you're telling? Or is it more about keeping momentum going?
Mm. keeping momentum going, I think, is important. You know, we're a team of five people working within different functions within the office. And keeping that momentum going and actually doing something is really important. Being a biannual and working full-time summer at times gets slow, even if we also have an online platform to look after. Mm. But we also feel that at times it holds us back, not being able to comment too much on kind of newsworthy stories, because when you come out twice a year, certain things seem a little bit old hat by the time the next issue is out. So we feel we can engage a little bit more with now, but also still keep that reflection and reporting that we have kind of become well known for. So I don't want us to become more light or more kind of easy on the eye or even easy on the words. We want to keep that kind of serious and quite academic approach that we've had from the beginning.
And I guess maintaining that rigor whilst also being, you know, more newsy almost is perhaps one of the sort of editorial challenges you'll face going forwards. James, where do you stand on this? Because obviously you've got a foot in several camps. You know, you're following and documenting developments in the architectural sector every day, every hour almost at times. But then you're also working in a more considered way, writing long-form pieces as a contributor to magazines like these. Does your approach have to be very, very different when you're writing about things, whether it's for digital publication, for maybe, you know, long form printed page, or do you find that there's certain, you know, fundamentals that you always have to adhere to, really?
I think there are fundamentals you always have to adhere to, but I think ultimately the greatest mistake that a lot of publishers make is that printed matter can be translated online. You know, I think they are fundamentally different things. And this is the argument in support of these things existing simultaneously. You know, this is why, you know, like you said, I've got a foot in both camps. I'm running on extremely fast-paced, high metabolism reporting. And at the same time, Lobby is biannual. It's much slower, but it's also about producing different kinds of material. And I think it's very disappointing when you see exceptional print magazines create an online platform which is just kind of just reciprocating what they've put in print, because it doesn't work. It never works. They're different things. And so obviously there's a fundamental challenge with, I would say, with rigor with online. Arc Daily, for example, has just launched Arc Daily China, and you know, we're broaching the issue of the fact that there are already several Arc Daily Chinas operating. It's a kind of copycat. And so how do you prove that you're the kind of the genuine article, which is obviously much easier to do when you're in print? Ultimately, they're different things, but they coexist beautifully, I think.
And I guess it's interesting to sort of touch on that idea of authenticity, which you mentioned there. Now, Ragnar, where's the authentic story of the developments in architecture told for you? Is it about particular titles that you follow? Do you have journals that you feel you're not getting a sense of what's really happening if you don't read them? Or is it more about networks? Is it more about the people that you talk to, that you meet? Where do you find the truths that shape your worldview when it comes to architecture?
I'm lucky in the sense that I am a product now of the Bartlett School of Architecture, which is the leading architecture school perhaps in the world. So I feel lucky to see the research that's happening there and kind of the publications that are coming from there and the school's energy and the design outcomes of the school, because they really do lead where architecture is going to go in the future. My personality is a bit different than what I feel, and academics will hate me for saying this, because I feel that it's very, very kind of uptight and very, very rigid at some point. And I almost feel that architects are expected to talk in a certain language and say certain things. So with Lobby, we're lobbying for a different kind of discourse. And it's not that the content isn't serious, it's just that it's more kind of accessible to other people who might not have anything to do with architecture, who don't have these understanding of architecture. So we're presenting stories which are authentic, and they are very real stories. I mean, for Abundance, for instance, we have very pressing matters such as the role of women in architecture, which has been greatly undervalued throughout years and years and years. But it's presented in a very kind of beautiful way as well. So it's engaging without compromising the quality of the content. But I do think that we can be more playful. Buildings, when you design buildings, sometimes they can be very playful. You design spaces to be playful. And I don't understand quite why in architectural publications we're not there yet. So I think that that's where what the kind of gap that we're trying to fill.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And I wonder, where do you look then for the cutting edge, if you like? Do you feel you need to look necessarily to practices and see what's happening there at the cutting edge, on the front line, if you like, of the trade? Or is it about you know, also looking at the world of academia and going back to the schools where architecture, where the discipline is being taught, where are the most compelling narratives in your view?
I think both. I mean, I think it's impossible to create a magazine with enough depth and interest without looking both to academia and to the industry. Personally, I think a lot of our stories and my team stories are created when we speak to people, and those people can both be part of practices, they can be teaching at institutions, so they can be the kind of industry leaders. And all of those people have interesting stories to tell. And I think it's just up to us to kind of distill them into the type of story that we want to publish. And often it's about having that unique point of view on something. You know, someone might be telling you something that they think is really interesting, but it might be just a detail of it that you latch onto that you kind of really then unpick and unravel and create a story that's kind of, for us, uniquely decennial. So this is the kind of beauty of working in journalism, writing about design and going after the stories that you like and really finding those special moments when you think this feels really good, this feels really unique to us.
Do you think there's a very different rhetoric? Is there a different vernacular, though, depending on, I mean, I guess it's obvious to a degree that, you know, for example, a student of architecture is going to maybe talk about his craft very differently from an architect who's been running a practice for 30, 40 years. But is there a very different rhetoric? And does that represent a challenge when it comes to telling those stories then to your readers?
Not for us, because I guess although we recognise that our readership is fairly professional and often working within the industry, the architecture world or the design world, we find that the way that we approach our stories are much more inspired by journalism, you know, so we don't try to kind of use the lingo of whatever kind of academic journals there are there, or even speak the language that a lot of architects speak, like you were referring to. I think that instead we try to just do, you know, research well, be quite in depth when we talk about our subject matters to make sure that we give the full picture and not just use kind of, you know, the shortcut kind of press release text, but actually find our own story and everything. So I think that we have always been inspired and informed by newspaper reporting, long form writing, such as, you know, the essays that you get in the New Yorker and so on. And those have always been our kind of starting points for the stories that we create.
Proper journalism. We like to talk about that on the Stack.
True, yeah. But also, just to say, it's interesting because the team behind us have all studied journalism, you know, so we're not necessarily just from the design world. We all have journalism degrees.
James, how accessible is the world of architecture and how much does the media that surrounds it, and there's a lot of it, much of it excellent, does it tell the story? Does it draw in people who don't have a professional connection? Does it do a good job, do you think?
On the whole, I'd say it doesn't. I mean, this is the kind of the beauty of Designer. I have a copy of the latest issue of Designer in front of me, and at once, I don't know how you feel, it feels like a little bit heavier, a little bit kind of more serious. I don't know, but at the same time, you know, this is what I really appreciate about Designer is the quality of the writing, which is possibly down to how you kind of create the stories, also the fact that they are journalistic pieces. The problem that we initially faced with Lobby was the fact that a lot of the contributors are students of architecture. And I think in architecture schools, you are kind of trained to be slightly egotistical about how you describe your own work. I think that certainly if anybody's ever had the pleasure of listening to an architect talk about their own building, it can sometimes get a little bit mundane, but they love it. They love talking about their buildings. And I think that the real challenge with Lobby, which I think we've quite successfully overcome, is really being serious, as Regna said, but also just allowing for a degree of levity. Because when you do that, when you do write from a slightly different angle on these things, it just suddenly becomes a pleasure to read. And if you ever read an architecture journal, a formal architecture journal, I mean, even if you love the subject like I do, it's not necessarily a pleasure to read.
It particularly becomes an issue when you say, we're accepting contributions, write something for us, and architects give us a particular type of writing that we don't want to go for. I want to pick up on what you said about having hefty pieces where you can really tell the story. And I think that that's an interesting pairing that we have here then, because we do the opposite. So people don't necessarily know if the Lobby is a journal or if it's a magazine. So they're always kind of like, oh, you work with Lobby Journal. I'm like, it's not, but it's also, you know, we're not giving you tips on how to bring costs down. It's not about that. It's a pleasure to read. And the way that I describe it is like architectural hors d'oeuvres. So we have this platter in front of you and we give you a small selection. And they're very, very short pieces, unless it's an interview. So they're usually around 800 to 900 pieces. And it's just about giving the reader, because we have, I mean, we're really young still. So we're kind of still determining who our core readers are.
Yeah.
But we have people who are first-year architecture students, and we have, you know, Daniel Libeskind, who subscribes to the magazine. So it's about giving everyone something that they can kind of taste and sample and have it be easy to digest at the same time.
Perfect. And a food metaphor, too, which is right up my street. These are the insights of Regna Ramos, Johanna Argwin-Ross, and James Taylor Foster, and we'll have more from them after this.
Just grow like a tree with the roots very deep on earth.
For the best in food and hospitality, tune into The Menu.
I learned that from a potato farmer way up in northern Maine. And he baked me a potato and it was like eating the best thing ever.
Monaco's program on food and drink introduces you to the most inspirational chefs, dedicated producers and innovative restaurateurs.
Some cinnamon syrup, a half an ounce of that. Got our Bosca Schnapps, an ounce of this.
So when you need inspiration for your dinner plans or want to find a new place for a superb cocktail, tune into The Menu with me, Marcus Hippi, premiering every Friday at 1900 London time.
It was really the River Cafe where I really just had a deep relationship with carrots. Vegetables, sorry, I said to say carrots, but I love carrots, so I meant vegetables in general.
You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Still with me, James Taylor Foster, Regna Ramos and Johanna Argwin-Ross. We've got a selection of magazines, your own and others, spread across the table. There's a beautiful bounty of magazines here in Studio One today. And I'd like to ask you a little bit about what you've chosen and how that inspires you. And it's interesting to note that not all of these are necessarily design or architecture titles. Johanna, perhaps if we come to you, maybe mention a couple of things you've got and maybe give us a sense of how they help you to fashion your craft and to inspire the editorial processes.
I have a copy of London Review of Books in front of me from last week. I just as I left to come here, I saw that this week's issue came out. One of the downsides with a weekly is you never have time to finish reading one before the next one is out. I should say I stole this from a colleague of mine who is...
Don't admit that now, they'll find out.
I brought this because in the new redesign of Decennia magazine, we have introduced reviews, which we actually didn't have before because we didn't necessarily feel that within the biannual that it had a room. But now we feel it does. And London Review of Books is a magazine that we really, really enjoy reading for its long-form reviews of books. And in this particular issue, John Lanchester has a very, very good essay on what is money and the kind of arrival of Bitcoin and how that changes our perception of currency. And in fact, it's something that I wish that we had written about in Decennio. And it's interesting because often when I go to these newspapers, books, magazines, I find that I don't read that much about other design and architecture journals. I look at them for information, but I don't necessarily kind of digest them for my own kind of inspiration. I tend to go to these type of platforms instead. And of course, it's a very, very good source for this sort of writing by some really brilliant writers.
Which always helps. Brilliant writing is something that generally works. James, I wonder, it's an interesting point, which I guess Johanna was alluding to there, which is when you start to look at other magazines, particularly if they're part of your business, if you like, do you separate James the reader from James the architectural mind? Do you look at them as a professional? Do you just say, oh, I wish I'd done that, or that's interesting? Or can you still enjoy... As a reader, can you kind of get back to the innocence of just reading something purely for the sake of it?
No, I think I lost my innocence many, many years ago. But
in literary terms, right?
Exactly, in literary terms. The fact is that, you know, I don't think, divide my professional mind from James the reader, which is I never thought I'd be talking about myself in the third person like that, but it's still a pleasure to read things. And what I tend to do now, I find myself doing, is reading a lot more literary stuff, actually. I mean, the London Review of Books is incredible because the review, as a format, is so difficult to get right. And, you know, attempted to write reviews myself before, and I don't think I've ever really successfully done it. And that's the beauty of it. And I know that there's, we may be in a bit of a resurgence of the review now. I think later this year, a new journal called, well, magazine, I'm not quite sure what to call it really, but The Real Review will be launched, which is also attempting to really tease out what that review is. And I think it will be extremely successful because more and more people I talk to are reading the London Review of Books now, which I have to say maybe 5 years ago wasn't quite the case. There seems to be something growing in that field.
Well, I wonder, there's so much white noise and there's such a preponderance of stuff we talk about, you know, there's too much unedited digital content which people feel barraged by. Maybe that, you know, the idea of criticism, quality thought, you know, let's hope that's having a resurgence because people like something that's been edited, something that's considered, something that's intelligent, dare I say it. What have you got though? You've got a couple of other titles. Maybe speak to why these things fit into this picture or don't.
This is called Matter, an Inverted Lens, and it's called Essays on Great Britain. And I picked this up actually in the Athenaeum in Amsterdam, which is a fantastic bookshop. You know, I've just been looking at a shelf. They've got a shelf in the bookshop called Brexit, which is a selection of books on the United Kingdom and Europe. And this is a really interesting look, quite in-depth and, you know, very, very considered series of essays on what England is, what Great Britain is, what the United Kingdom is. In particular, there's a very nice essay about the Falkland Islands, or the Malvinas, depending on your political position, which is basically a photo essay of photos and an interview by Jon Tonks, who is about to release a book called Empire. They have this incredible selection of photographs, particularly the layout, actually. There's one page I'm looking at here with a kind of Phineas Fogg-esque man holding a weather balloon who apparently each day at 11:15 fills a weather balloon with hydrogen to test the weather. And I just think it's a beautiful picture on what's going on in this strange place that's so distant from England, yet is so English. And really, the magazine touches upon so many issues. Also, a series of domestic photographs by photographer Richard Billingham, which are of his parents. And for me, there's slightly this kind of lady languishing on a kind of nicotine-stained sofa. but it, to me, it's England. I don't know.
It could be the way that the fabric of her dress blends into the wallpaper design.
That's also
it
true.
It takes us back to the 70s England, definitely. It's great to continue to delve. Regna, tell us what you're looking at.
I just picked up this copy of Rubbish Fanzine, it's called, the other day when I went into the Mac Culture Shop, and I thought it was such a cool project. It's this family in Singapore. It's this dad, the mom, and their two kids, a boy and a girl, and they just seem to be a hyper-creative family, and they put together, it was really, seems to be something that was for them that people just kind of engaged with, and it's about their trip to Tokyo and Kyoto. And it's about how this family navigates through these different cities that they don't understand the language and how they use Google. But the beauty is that they all get involved. So even the kids have a say and they'll put captions on the pictures about what the kids say. They'll give the pictures the kids' camera so they'll take their own 35mm pictures. And you see the same thing through these very different eyes at different ages. And it's just this beautiful project, and it's so simple, but I read a lot, so I quite like to have also magazines that are very visual, that feel good or that look nice as objects. I think that's also really important. I really love what they've done with this issue, and each issue is very, very different as well, so I'm really, really seduced by it, and
it's a fantastic project. And I think what you struck upon there, which is really interesting about Rubbish, is this, and they call it, as you said, a fanzine, because it is this very personal. It feels like almost like a private journal.
Yeah.
And the others, if you read them, they have that same quality, and yet they seem to capture such universal truths as well, which is really extraordinary. It's an amazing project, and sometimes they present them very differently in different
containers,
things like
elements,
found objects, and they're tiny print runs. I know this has been reprinted, but originally it was only in the 300s, I think.
Yeah. I know that there is one issue that comes with, because sometimes they come with little knickknacks and stuff, and one of them, they just pick up on really subtle things. So they were talking about how the dad closes his eyes every time they take a picture, so they came up with this little tiny faux doctor's note diagnosing that as like a sickness of, you know, so I just think it's really funny.
That happens to me all the time.
No, there's an incredible lightness of touch with it. Johan, let's move on. You've got another, what's this, A Vision in Pink, this magazine that you have in front of you?
I pronounce it Vistoy, and so does the founder, but it might be Vistorge, I'm not sure, but it's garments or clothing in Esperanto. It's issue 7 of Vistoy, the Journal of Sartorial Matters. which is created by a Swedish writer and academic called Anja Kronberg Aronofsky, and she's based in Paris. She works together with the London Culture of Fashion on this journal, so a little bit like you with Lobby. And it comes out only yearly, so this is the latest issue. And for me, it's interesting. It has a new creative direction, just like my own Decennio and by Studio Blanco in Milan. And I think that it's sort of really brought this annual journal forward in a really nice way. It's always had a lot of interesting reading material. It's a magazine about clothing, fashion, and what happens when it kind of goes out into the world. And each issue is themed. This one is on failures. But it also engages quite strongly with industry. So it's not just about kind of what happens with clothing when it ends up in your wardrobe, but it also engages with the industry and how the industry works and operates, because of course it's a very multifaceted world, the fashion world, of kind of, you know, style icons and front row celebrities and so on. And this is kind of dissecting that and looking at it from many different perspectives. And there's some really great in-depth interviews in this one, talking specifically on people's perception of failures within that world. So I think it's something that's very worth picking up, and I always enjoy reading it and spend a lot of time with it after it's come out. You know, I used the whole year to
consume it.
Exactly.
Well, that's always, it's funny, we've all been talking about, you know, collectability, about spending time, about actually taking the time to read these things. And I suppose, as we always say, that's the measure, I guess, of a really successful publication, if you treasure it, and also if you really read it from cover to cover. I guess that's what we all want people to do with the products we make. There we must leave it. It's been wonderful to speak to you all. Thank you to James Taylor Foster, European Editor at Large for archdaily.com, co-curator of the Nordic Pavilion at the upcoming Venice Biennale. We didn't even talk about that, James. So much excitement to look forward to.
That was a wonderful interview, a really wonderful interview with Alejandro Aravena in the issue of Decennio, who is the director of the Biennale this year.
We're all connected one way or the other. James is also an editor of Lobby magazine. Its editor-in-chief is Dr. Regna Ramos. Regna, thank you for being on the programme as well.
Thank you. I'm loving the new title. It's recent. I've only been a doctor for 7 days.
Oh, well, that's very, it's very important.
You've changed,
Regna. It's very important to mention. And thanks to Johanna Agerman-Ross, editor-in-chief of the brand newly relaunched Decennio magazine, the quarterly journal of design, as we can now call it. I urge people to pick up a copy. Thanks to you all for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that is all we have time for on this week's programme. My thanks to our producers Ben Rylan and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and editor Claire Urban. Comments or queries are welcome. Drop us a note at info@monocle.com, and don't forget to join us at the same time next Saturday. You can always listen again at monocle.com or via your preferred platform if you can't wait that long. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for listening.